From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
The president has taken this nation into an illegal and unconstitutional war. He has committed high crimes. These are impeachable offenses, and this president should be charged with having committed the highest of all crimes, causing thousands of deaths.
Attorney John Boniface, author of Warrior King, The Case for Impeaching George W. Bush, will talk about why he's suing both President Bush and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. We'll also take a look at the case of a Saudi graduate student arrested on terrorism charges. He ran a number of Islamic websites. A jury found him innocent last week. He remains in prison. But first, we'll go to Iraq to speak with a spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross. Stay with us. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, the security chief of the northern oil fields was shot dead earlier today as he traveled to work in Kirkuk. Ghazi al-Talabani is the third top Iraqi official to be assassinated in a week. The killing marks the latest attack on the country's oil industry, which has been crippled by sabotage. Over the past 2 days, Iraq has been forced to stop exporting oil from two of its busiest southern terminals in Basra and Khor Alamaya after saboteurs attacked nearby pipelines. A pipeline in northern Iraq was also targeted Tuesday. Iraq is losing an estimated $60 million a day from stalled oil exports. According to the BBC, 98% of Iraqi government revenues come from oil. A new poll commissioned by the U.S.-led coalition provisional government has found 92% of Iraqis consider the U.S. an occupying force. More than half believe all Americans behave like those portrayed at the Abu Ghraib prison abuse photos. 55% report they would feel safer if U.S. troops left immediately. As for the so-called handover of power on June 30th, 63% of Iraqis believe conditions will improve. The AP obtained a copy of the study, which the U.S. was not planning to release to the public. The New York Times reports the 9/11 Commission will issue a report Thursday strongly criticizing the Pentagon's Domestic Air Defense Command for being disastrously unprepared on the morning of September 11th, 2001. A draft of the report reads, quote, "On the morning of 9/11, the existing protocol was unsuited in every respect for what was about to happen. What ensued was a hurried attempt to create an improvised defense by officials who had never encountered or trained against the situation they faced." In Virginia, three Muslim men were sentenced to prison terms after the government accused the men of training for holy war abroad by playing paintball games in Virginia. One man was sentenced to life, another to 85 years, the third got 8 years. The men were accused of being connected to a Pakistani group which is trying to drive India from the disputed region of Kashmir. In an unusual development, the judge in the case, U.S. District Court Judge Lani Brinkema, called the lengthy sentences appalling and draconian, but said she had no choice under federal law. She said, quote, "We have murderers who get far less time. I've sent al-Qaeda members planning attacks on these shores to less time. This is sticking in my craw. Law and justice at times need to be in tune." One of the defendant's attorneys called the sentence, quote, "the greatest miscarriage of justice of any case he's seen in 34 years of practice." The Senate Tuesday renewed its support for developing a new generation of nuclear weapons. Democrats unsuccessfully tried to kill provisions in a defense bill that allocates $28 million for the study of a nuclear weapon capable of penetrating underground bunkers and $9 million to help develop smaller nuclear weapons. Vice President Cheney's office has confirmed that Cheney's chief of staff, Scooter Libby, was contacted in 2002 about Halliburton receiving a secret contract to develop post-war plans in Iraq, but Cheney's office is claiming the vice president himself was never notified. In the West Bank, hundreds of Palestinian villagers pelted Israeli bulldozers with stones today to protest the beginning of work to incorporate the major Jewish settlement of Ariel within the West Bank wall, which Palestinians describe as an apartheid wall. In other news from the area, the Israeli Attorney General has dropped a corruption investigation into Israeli Prime Minister General Ariel Sharon. A new book by New York University professor Joshua Goldstein is estimating the average U.S. household is now paying $500 per month to cover the costs of the U.S. war efforts. Goldstein says it's as if the government set up a meter in each household and forced the residents to put a quarter in every 20 minutes of every day of the year. Goldstein said the $500 figure does not calculate the less tangible costs of war, such as lost lives and budget pressures on health care and education. Goldstein reports in his findings in the forthcoming book titled The Real Price of War, in which he argues the government should spend even more money to win the so-called war on terror. In Brunswick, Georgia, 10 people remain jailed nearly a week after they were arrested at protests near the Group of Eight summit on Sea Island. The activists have refused to give their names or post bail in protest of the government's crackdown on demonstrators during the summit. In a statement from jail, the group, which is being called the Brunswick 10, said, quote, "The injuries we've sustained this week while speaking out have done less damage to our bodies than the governor's casual militarization of civilian law enforcement has done to American democracy." The Food and Drug Administration announced yesterday it has redesignated frozen French fries as fresh vegetables. Many commentators compared the decision to the FDA's decision under President Reagan to classify ketchup as a vegetable. In Australia, the McDonald's fast food chain has launched a multi-million dollar PR campaign against the new documentary Supersize Me. The film chronicles the effects of a man who ate nothing but McDonald's for 30 days. In the U.S., McDonald's has said little about the film, but it no longer offers supersize meal deals. In other film news, Michael Moore is appealing the Motion Picture Association's decision to rate his new film, Fahrenheit 9/11, R, because it contains, quote, violent and disturbing images and for language. The president of Lionsgate Film responded to the decision by saying, quote, "Frankly, I don't consider any of the images in the film any more disturbing than what we have all seen on the cable news networks and the gratuitous violence that fills the screen of so many PG-13 rated action pictures." Moore said, quote, "It is sadly very possible that many 15 and 16-year-olds will be asked and recruited to serve in Iraq in the next couple of years. If they're old enough to be recruited and capable of being in combat and risking their lives," Moore said, "they certainly deserve the right to see what is going on in Iraq." The film opens across the country a week from Friday.
مالي شغل بالسوق مريت اشوفك مالي شغل بالسوق مريت اشوفك عطشان حفنا سنين واروح على شوفك عطشان حفنا سنين واروح على شوفك مالي شغل بالسوق مريت اشوفك مالي شغل بالسوق مريت اشوفك عطشان حفنا سنين واروح على شوفك عطشان حفنا سنين واروح على شوفك اشوفك عطيش انا حفن سنين واروى على اشوفك اريد اتبع الدلال بي وصلك وراوي اريد اتبع الدلال واصلك وراوي وبعين خلي يشوف هجر شعيم
Iraqi musician Amer Taufik here on Democracy Now! From the soundtrack of the film about Baghdad. This is the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Iraqi official in charge of setting up a tribunal to try former Iraqi government members, Salam Chalabi, says he expects to file criminal charges against Saddam Hussein and others before the June 30th so-called transfer of power. Salam Chalabi is the nephew of the U.S.-backed Iraqi exile leader, Ahmed Chalabi, who's been accused of leaking U.S. secrets to Iran. On Monday, Iraq's interim prime minister, Iyad Alawi, said he wants Hussein to be handed over to the interim Iraqi government in 2 weeks. But President Bush is refusing to set a timetable to release him to the Iraqi authorities. Speaking to reporters outside the White House yesterday, President Bush said appropriate security must be in place before the U.S. hands over Saddam Hussein.
I just want to make sure that when sovereignty is transferred, Saddam Hussein stays in jail. That's just a matter of discussion and understanding the procedures. That's all we're saying. I'm confident that when it's all said and done, he will stay in jail. I just want to be assured. Listen, we're over there for a reason. We're over there to make our country more secure, and one way to do so was to make sure Saddam Hussein was not in power. Secondly, we're there to help the Iraqi people. And we want to make sure that he doesn't come back to power. And so, therefore, it's a legitimate question to ask of the interim government. How are you going to make sure he stays in jail?
President Bush speaking outside the White House yesterday. U.S. occupation leader Paul Bremer told the Washington Post the U.S. could transfer legal custody of Saddam Hussein but retain physical custody. Saddam Hussein has been held at an undisclosed location since his capture by U.S. forces in December and is being interrogated by the CIA and FBI. Speculation about Saddam Hussein's fate was raised after the Red Cross insisted Sunday the U.S. cannot continue to hold Saddam Hussein, who's been designated a prisoner of war by the U.S. after the formal end of the occupation. Just before the program, we reached Nada Dumani, spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross in Baghdad. The line isn't great, but Nada Dumani talked about what the Red Cross is saying about what should happen to Saddam Hussein.
You know, Saddam Hussein has been granted by the U.S. authorities the status of prisoner of war. The Third Geneva Convention applies to it. And the Geneva Conventions are very clear in stating that all persons suspected of having violated international humanitarian law are accountable for their actions. And this includes anybody, a prisoner of war or a civilian internee or a detainee protected by the Fourth Geneva Convention. So any violation of international humanitarian law should be properly investigated. Those responsible, be it Saddam Hussein or any other one, should be prosecuted in full accordance with the law.
What is the U.S. government telling you right now?
Sorry, I didn't get your question.
What is the U.S. government telling you right now?
Well, I think the U.S. know perfectly well about the law, and we have no comment. I mean, what do you want to know about what the U.S. are saying? I think it would be better to put the question directly to them, if you don't mind.
I am wondering if the Red Cross is in dialogue with the U.S. government, what their response is to you.
No, we have no comments on that. Mm. We do have permanent dialogue with the U.S. authorities, be it in Baghdad or elsewhere, And we are, I think, when we stick to the law, what we say is the Geneva Conventions, and I believe the U.S. are sticking also by the Geneva Convention, and they can also say, they know perfectly well what's in the conventions, and I don't think there is any confusion on what's written in the conventions. The only problem is that sometimes there are different interpretations, especially when they are relayed by the media. But as saying that somebody should be released, nobody ever said that the ICRC has any power or any authority or any judicial mandate to decide on who should be released or shouldn't be released. And the only thing that we can say is that people charged can be convicted and tried according they have to follow a fair trial with judicial guarantees. And those who have no charges against them, obviously, they cannot be held in detention and indefinitely.
How many other people would you say are in the same category as Saddam Hussein?
Well, as prisoners, as I said, Saddam Hussein is a prisoner of war. So far, in Iraq, there are something well, probably a little bit less than 50 people who have the status of prisoner of war.
We're talking to Nada Doumani, spokesperson for the International Red Cross. She is in Baghdad. You are also saying the Red Cross has said that they told the United States, the government, and the military that soldiers were being mistreated. Can you tell us where the Red Cross has found this and when the Red Cross knew this?
Did the Red Cross say anything about soldiers being mistreated? I'm not aware of such a report or such a declaration. I didn't get unless I didn't get your question well.
I'm sorry, I meant prisoners. That prisoners were
prisoners
being mistreated.
Prisoners were being mistreated?
Yes, the Red Cross has said...
Are you referring to Abu Ghraib?
Yes.
The Abu Ghraib case?
Yes.
Well, the Abu Ghraib case, I think we have spoken a lot about it. That's part of the reports that we make to the detaining authorities precisely aim at including recommendations, remarks, concerns based on our visit to detention places. So when we visited Abu Ghraib and other detention places, we issued a report that's a standard ICRC procedure. We issue a report that we handed over to the detaining authorities, to the U.S., which included a series of recommendations and remarks.
And when was the first report of prisoners being abused handed over by the Red Cross to the U.S.?
The first report concerning Abu Ghraib specifically, only Abu Ghraib as a detention place, was rather a working paper that was handed over to the U.S. in November last year, early November, following our visit to Abu Ghraib. And then in February this year, there was a more comprehensive report covering different detention places over a period of starting from March 2003 up to November 2004. I believe you're mentioning this one, which the media has commented a lot on it because it was leaked, definitely not by us, but by somebody to an American newspaper.
And what was the U.S. response in November when the Red Cross gave the report that prisoners were being abused at Abu Ghraib?
Well, first, please let me correct you. I never said that in the report in November we spoke about what we spoke specifically. Our reports are to remain confidential. Confidentiality is for us an important means in order for us to keep on visiting detainees in all over the world. It doesn't apply only in Iraq. And as usual, as I said, the working paper is handed over to the authorities, and this is part of a dialogue we have with them. We comment and we discuss with them all the issues that we're bringing about, and if we believe there are improvements to be made, then we ask them to carry out these improvements.
Nada Doumani, spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross, speaking to us from Baghdad. You are listening to Democracy Now! Next Tuesday, June 22nd, former President Bill Clinton's much-anticipated memoir, My Life, is hitting the bookstores. The 1,000-page book is expected to top the bestseller list. There are already pre-orders of more than the 1.5 million copies that have been printed. One of the main reasons for the book's popularity is undoubtedly Clinton's account of events that led him to become the second American president in U.S. history to be impeached. Clinton denied having a sexual affair with Monica Lewinsky, a young intern who'd worked at the White House. But in December 98, a Republican-dominated House voted to impeach Clinton, charging him with lying under oath to a federal grand jury and obstructing justice. While Clinton was impeached over a personal scandal, some say President George W. Bush should be impeached for more serious crimes. When we come back from our break, we'll be joined by attorney John Boniface, who has sued President Bush over the invasion of Iraq. He's also written a book called Warrior King, The Case for Impeaching George W. Bush. We'll be back with him in a minute. فاتما سلم عليه يمكن الحيل وزعلان جت لها يا حلوة رويني وعطشان مي يسقيني عطشان مي يسقيني وقالت لي روح يا مسكيني وقالت لي روح يا مسكيني مينا ما تروي العطشان طالع من بيت ابوها رايح البيت الجيران فاتما سلم علي يمكن الحيل
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, broadcasting on more than 220 radio and television stations. Around the country. I think we'll go to a break one more time.
طالع من بيت ابوها رايح البيت الجيران فات ما سلم علي يمكن الحيل وزعلان طالع من بيت ابوها رايح البيت الجيران فات ما سلم علي يمكن الحيل وزعلان قلت لها يا حلوة رويني وعطشان مي يسقيني قلت لها يا حلوة رويني عطشان مي يسقيني وقالت لي روح يا مسكيني وقالت لي روح يا مسكيني مينا ما تروي العطشان طالع
This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to John Boniface, an attorney who's written the book Warrior King, The Case for Impeaching George W. Bush. John Boniface, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. Thank you for having me.
Lay out your case.
This president has taken this nation into an illegal and unconstitutional war. The president is not a king. He does not have the power to take the nation to war without Congress first authorizing it, first either declaring war or taking equivalent action. Congress never authorized this war, despite the myth of what Congress did in October 2002, and the president never had the authority, therefore, to launch this first strike invasion against Iraq. Furthermore, beyond that trampling of the Constitution and taking this nation into legal war, causing thousands of deaths, we now know that the president lied to the United States Congress and to the American people about the reasons for taking the nation to war. Weapons of mass destruction, none of which have been found. Alleged links to al-Qaeda, none of which have been proven true. This president and his senior advisors who took this nation into this illegal war should should now be held accountable for these impeachable offenses. These are the highest of all crimes that can possibly be considered as an impeachable offense, and the charge should be made. There's no immunity, even in an election year, to presidents being charged with impeachable offenses if they've committed them. This president should be charged with having taken this nation in legal war and having violated the oath of office in the Constitution and deserving impeachment.
Who is Elbridge Gerry?
Elbridge Gerry is a delegate from Massachusetts to the Constitutional Convention back in 1787, who rose to object when it was suggested that the president would have the sole power for taking the nation into war. And his objection carried the day. Elbridge Gerry was proven right. The delegates to the Constitutional Convention authored the War Powers Clause of the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11, which states very clearly that Congress and only Congress has the power to start a war against another nation, to declare war. And this is not a power that can be transferred to the President of the United States. And yet that's essentially what Congress did in October 2002. It said to the President, you decide whether or not to take this nation to war. We're not going to decide. We'll hand that decision-making authority over to you. They didn't have the ability to hand that decision-making authority over to the President under the Constitution, and the President didn't have the ability to seize it. He seized the powers of a king in taking this nation in illegal war. And now, more than ever, we've got to stand up for the Constitution. We've got to stand up for democracy and demand accountability for the high crimes this president has committed.
You've sued President Bush. On what grounds?
We represented a coalition of United States soldiers, parents of soldiers, and members of Congress, led by Congressman John Conyers Jr. and Dennis Kucinich, who charged that the president did not have the authority to launch this first strike invasion of Iraq. We filed this suit in February 2003 on the eve of the Iraq War. We were treated on an expedited basis up to the Federal Appeals Court. The Federal Appeals Court, despite the district courts dealing with this, treated it seriously and had tough questions for both sides, including the Justice Department, which came out in full force on behalf of the president. But in the end, these judges did not have the courage to stand up to this president, did not have the courage to do their duty under the Constitution, which is to uphold and protect it. And they let this president take this nation into an illegal war. And so the remaining remedy is with we the people. We the people who have the power to demand the removal from office of anyone who commits impeachable offenses, who commits high crimes. That's why the framers put that provision in the Constitution. This is an indictment that ought to be made of the President of the United States. He ought to be charged with having committed these crimes. We ought to enter a debate in this country, in the halls of Congress and around this nation, as to whether or not the president can take the nation into an illegal war, resulting in thousands of deaths, and not be held accountable. We need to demand accountability of this president and of his senior advisors for doing this.
Name some of the people that you are representing who joined the suit.
Well, there were, first of all, three John Doe plaintiffs, three United States soldiers whose identities remain protected because of the fear of retaliation they would face in the United States military for bringing this case. But there were parents of soldiers led by Charlie Richardson and Nancy Lesson, who are courageous leaders and the founders, co-founders of Military Families Speak Out, who have spoken all around this country on behalf of military families in opposition to this war. And then, of course, there were members of Congress, led by Congressman John Conyers Jr., Dennis Kucinich, Jose Serrano, Jesse Jackson Jr., Sheila Jackson Lee, all of whom had the courage, 12 of them, to stand up and take this president on. And now I think one member of Congress, at least, if not more, ought to have the courage again to charge this president with what he's done, impeachable offenses, introduce articles of impeachment, or at the very least, a resolution of inquiry, which would begin the process of investigating whether or not this president has committed impeachable offenses.
When was the last time Congress voted for war?
Well, first, this is not a magic words test. Congress last formally declared war in World War II, but Congress has taken other actions in other wars that have indicated some level of involvement. They've appropriated money during the Vietnam War. They issued mandatory draft requirements during the Vietnam War. But we didn't have anything like that on the eve of the invasion of Iraq. We had no appropriations for this invasion. We had no mandatory draft. All we had was the October resolution, which Senator Robert Byrd, someone who has a command of the United States history, called a rag of a resolution, a piece of cowardice. It did not authorize war. It simply sought to transfer to the president the decision-making power of whether or not to take this nation to war. And the president embraced it. He went all around the country saying, I'll decide whether or not we go to war against Iraq. I'll let you know. And the world waited for this one individual with this awesome power to take this nation to war. This is the power of kings and queens of European monarchs of the past, and this is not the power of a president in a democracy.
What happened to your lawsuit?
The judges did not have the courage in the end to intervene. They initially ruled at the appellate level that it was not ripe, that the facts were not there, showing that the UN Security Council was not going to approve this war and the president would take the nation into war nonetheless unilaterally. Once those facts emerged, which supported our alternative argument that if the Congress approved this war, it only did so with condition that the UN would support it. Once those facts emerged, the court ducked. It chose not to intervene. It issued a one-paragraph ruling after that 30-page ruling saying the facts are still not there. Sadly, this is a story of all three institutions of government, the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch, letting us down, failing us in their abilities and responsibilities with respect to the Constitution. And now it's up to us, we the people, to demand that document back.
Now, didn't the federal court say that you're raising political questions and issues in this case that could only be answered by the political representatives?
Well, they said essentially that when Congress and the president are not in conflict on a matter of war and peace, that they were not going to intervene. But that effectively would mean that Congress and the president can collude together to violate the Constitution, and the courts have no ability to step in and intervene. In 1803, Chief Justice Marshall said that it is the duties of the courts to declare what the law is. That's all we sought in this case, and yet these courts refuse to declare what the law is. They refuse to interpret the Constitution and the October 2002 resolution for what it was, which was not an authority given to the president at all. It was, in fact, transferring to the president his decision-making power of whether or not to take the nation into war.
Since you've written Warrior King, the case for impeaching George W. Bush, have you come up with more reasons why George W. Bush should be impeached?
Unfortunately, yes. I mean, Bob Woodward's book, Plan of Attack, reveals that $700 million was secretly appropriated from the war in Afghanistan to the buildup in the war of Iraq. This is a la Iran-Contra. The president doesn't have the power to appropriate money. Only Congress does. It's another violation of the Constitution. And now this torture scandal. If the president condoned torture, the president deserves to face impeachment charges. Let's be clear here. This cannot be any clearer. If the president was involved in seeing memos from the Justice Department, from the Pentagon, that suggested that torture would be permissible of prisoners in Afghanistan or in Iraq or Guantanamo or anywhere else, this president deserves to face impeachment charges. If he does not, then the Constitution suffers. We're effectively allowing the Constitution to be suspended in order for this president to have these kinds of powers. We cannot declare post-911 by fiat that the president is now king on matters of foreign policy, that the president can take us into wars on his own personal whim. We cannot allow that to happen. It's the destruction of the Constitution if we allow that to happen. We have to stand up and protect it.
How does this case compare to what happened to President Clinton, his impeachment?
Well, there's obviously no real comparison. President Clinton committed allegedly perjury and obstruction of justice, charges for which he was facing impeachment in the House of Representatives and did have that vote of impeachment in the House, was not convicted in the Senate. But no one died. No one died in the Monica Lewinsky affair. This president has taken this nation to war, resulting in the deaths of 800-plus United States soldiers, thousands of Iraqi civilians dead, hundreds and thousands of Iraqi civilians permanently injured, as well as soldiers on our side. This president should be held accountable for all of that. He should be held accountable for taking this nation into this war that continues to spiral out of control. There's no real comparison to that and the Monica Lewinsky affair. And if we're going to impeach a president for alleged perjury and obstruction of justice, surely we ought to debate whether or not we should impeach a president for taking the nation into an illegal war.
Who determines that debate?
That debate is first determined by we the people. There are two websites, impeachcentral.com and impeachnow.org, in which people can weigh in on this question, call their members of Congress, urge them to introduce articles of impeachment or at least a resolution of inquiry that begins the investigation. But it only takes one member of Congress in earnest to begin this debate in the halls of Congress. One member of Congress can step up and demand that we have an investigation as to whether or not these are impeachable offenses. And I think that we, the people, need to pressure our members of Congress to demand that that investigation begin now.
Representative John Conyers wrote the introduction to your book.
He did, and he was a plaintiff in the case we brought, and I think he's one person who ought to be called upon. He's obviously the dean of the Congressional Black Caucus, somebody who was on the Watergate committee. He knows about impeachable offenses, and he ought to be asked to take this stand again. They had the courage to sue the president on the eve of the Iraq War. They ought to have the courage again to stand up and demand that this president now be held accountable for these impeachable offenses.
I asked Dennis Kucinich, Democratic presidential candidate during the New Hampshire primary about the idea of impeaching George Bush. And he said the people make that decision essentially when they vote. They can decide to vote him out of office. In fact, he said, well, why make a martyr out of him before?
Well, with all due respect to my former client, who I'm proud to have represented, the reality here is that the impeachment proceeding is a quasi-political and constitutional proceeding. It involves taking evidence. It involves subpoenas. It involves discovery powers. It involves putting people under oath. All of that does not take place on Election Day. And yes, we're having an election in November of this year, but we ought not to look back in January 2005 with the possible reclaiming of the White House by George W. Bush and say, oh, now we ought to look at whether or not he committed impeachable offenses. Nixon survived through the 1972 election only to face impeachment charges in 1973 and 74. We ought to begin this inquiry now. The people of this country ought to have this debate placed before them as to whether or not these are impeachable offenses. This is a debate that ought to begin in earnest now.
Why do you think the Democrats don't take this up in the way that the Republicans so zealously did when it came to President Clinton?
I think, unfortunately, the Democrats are scared. They somehow believe that the commander-in-chief has powers that the framers never intended. And in this time of war, they don't want to speak out on this kind of question against the commander-in-chief. But now with these torture memos, I think it has to be eminently clear that the president deserves to face this inquiry.
John Boniface, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
John Boniface is author of Warrior King, The Case for Impeaching George W. Bush. This is Democracy Now! Let me read you something from today's Washington Post. A federal judge imposed a life prison sentence yesterday on one member of the alleged Virginia Jihad Network and an 85-year term on another. In an unusual criticism of her own ruling, the judge said she found it appalling but had no choice under strict sentencing guidelines. U.S. District Judge Leonie Brinkema said the 85-year sentence she handed down to defendant Syphilis Chapman, who's 31 years old, was, quote, sticking in my craw. Chapman and co-defendants Masood Khan and Hamad Abdurrahim were convicted by Brinkema in March of conspiring to aid a Muslim group fighting India that the government has deemed a terrorist organization. The judge told an Alexandria courtroom packed with supporters of the three men, quote, what Mr. Chapman has been found guilty of is a serious crime, but there are murderers who have served far less time. She said, I have sentenced al-Qaeda members who are planning attacks on these shores to far less time. In sentencing Khan to life in prison and Abdurrahim to 97 months, Brinkema closed an unusual case in which 11 Muslim men were originally charged with taking part in paramilitary training, including playing paintball in the Virginia countryside to prepare for holy war abroad. Six defendants pleaded guilty. Only Chapman Khan and Abdurrahim went to trial. Two others were acquitted. We go now to John Zwirling, who is an attorney based in Alexandria, Virginia. He represents Sefula Chapman in the Virginia paintball case. His client again sentenced to 85 years in jail. We're talking to Mr. Zwirling on his cell phone in his car. Welcome to Democracy Now.
Good morning, Amy.
Can you tell us what happened here?
Well, at what point? I mean, this case was conceived in ignorance and a misunderstanding of what Islam is all about. And it proceeded under a rush to prosecute Muslims. I really believe that. And I didn't believe that when I first got into the case, but I came to believe that. They misused the term jihad throughout the entire trial. You even are now referring to it as the Virginia Jihad Trial because that's the name that the government gave it, so it would have a flashy a ring in the press. And jihad is, you probably know, and many of your listeners probably know, it means struggle for good or struggle for God, and it is everything from depriving yourself from certain pleasures in the service of God, trying to live a good life, to including violent struggle in self-defense, but always within the laws of the land that you live in. And this is my understanding from having spent about a year in this case and talking to a lot of people. And, you know, when a group of young men started to play paintball, some of them were doing it in what they say was preparation for jihad. But they didn't mean going abroad and killing people. They meant preparing themselves to be able to respond to whatever the future might hold, whether it was defending your family from attacks, as many Muslims were required to do after 9/11, including my client, who's home was defaced and people banging on his doors and scrolling obscenities on his windows. You know, to, you know, just being prepared. And he got all twisted around, and it was very sad.
Well,
very sad to see.
I would like to ask you about the judge's comments. That's pretty astounding that she first sentenced your client to 85 years in prison and then said that she found it appalling that she did that, that the sentence is sticking in her craw, but that she has no choice. Explain.
All right. Well, in under the federal system, there are mandatory minimum sentences that are applied to certain offenses. There are mandatory guidelines that judges have to live with because Congress has refused to allow judges to use common sense and judicial discretion in fashioning appropriate sentences. And they oftentimes result in the law not allowing justice to appear in the courtrooms, especially for people who go to trial. And this is not unique to this case. There are a lot of federal judges who have resigned their positions over the drug laws, where there are these horrendous minimum mandatory penalties for first offenders, where crack cocaine is treated 20 times more, 100 times more harshly than powder cocaine, even though the government knows that crack cocaine is primarily a prosecution of minorities and powder cocaine less so, and so it has that discriminatory effect. And, for example, possession of 5 grams of cocaine carries a 5-year minimum mandatory penalty, and 5-year powder cocaine, you can get probation. You know, it's not unique. And in this case, the possessing a firearm to go hunting, and also becoming more proficient which you would expect when a person goes target shooting, became a 30-year offense, mandatory minimum.
John Zwirling, we're also joined by constitutional attorney David Cole. We're actually having him on to talk about a different case. In this case, a young man who was acquitted who ran websites. But before we go to break, David Cole, I wanted to get your comment on this case and the judge's own comments after she sentenced Zwirling's client to 85 years in prison, saying she found what she was doing appalling.
Well, I think it is appalling, and I think it's a reflection of how crazy we have gotten in this war on terrorism. There's a case right now pending on appeal to the Fourth Circuit in Virginia, which involved a guy who was convicted of smuggling cigarettes across state lines and then donating $3,000 of the proceeds to Hezbollah. No proof that he was sending it for any sort of illegal purpose, that it furthered any kind of illegal purpose. His co-conspirators got five-year sentences. But because he was convicted of also having distributed, or not distributed, but made a donation to Hezbollah in Lebanon, he got a 155-year sentence. I mean, the sentences are just completely out of whack with any sort of common sense and with any sort of moral culpability.
We are going to break, and then we're going to talk about another case. I want to thank John Zwirling, attorney based in Alexandria, Virginia, who represents Sefula Chapman in the Virginia paintball case. His client was just sentenced to 85 years in jail, the judge objecting to her own sentence that she handed down to this man. Also, we're speaking to David Cole, who will stay with us so we can talk about another case. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In February 2003, the FBI raided the home of a Saudi student at the University of Idaho. Sami Omar al-Hussein, 34 years old, PhD candidate, studied in the U.S. for 9 years, was volunteering his time to a Michigan-based group, the Islamic Assembly of North America, to set up a website that promoted the study of Islam. The website contained a link to another website set up by a group the U.S. government had listed as a terrorist organization. Another link pointed to a site that advocated suicide bombings in Israel and Chechnya. Al-Hussein was arrested and charged with 3 counts of terrorism, 4 counts of making false statements, 7 counts of visa fraud. The terrorism charges against him were made under the Patriot Act, charging with providing, quote, expert guidance or assistance to groups deemed terrorist. In the year before Sami al-Hussein was arrested, the government closely tracked him by intercepting 29,000 emails and phone calls. Well, last week, after more than a year in jail, A jury found al-Hussein innocent of most of the charges, including all three terrorism charges, dealing the Justice Department a major defeat. The trial, which lasted 7 weeks, featured a convicted terrorist who said he was influenced by al-Hussein's web writings and retired CIA operative Frank Anderson, who was the only witness called by defense attorneys. After the acquittal, Anderson said, quote, "I'm embarrassed and ashamed that our government has kept a decent an innocent man in jail for a very long time." Hussein remains in prison on immigration charges. We're joined now by Marwan Mossad, a personal friend of Sami Omar al-Hussein, visited Sami many times in jail. At the University of Idaho, both Sami and Marwan served terms as heads of the Muslim Student Association. And David Cole, professor at Georgetown Law School and author of the book Enemy Aliens, Double Standards and Constitutional Freedom in the War on Terrorism. David, if you can just summarize what happened in this case on the terrorism charges.
Well, what happened, I think, is that the jury stood up for the First Amendment and rejected the government's charges, which were really probably the most extreme application of the material support statute that we have seen since 9/11. This statute, the material support statute, has become the Ashcroft Justice Department's favorite statute to use against against individuals in "quote unquote" terrorism cases. It's the same statute that was used in the Virginia paintball case that we just finished talking about. But in this case, the charge was that he had provided expert advice or assistance to terrorist groups by having these links on his website. And so you had a situation in which the government was seeking to criminalize him for pure speech, the fact that there were sermons on websites that endorsed terrorism. And it wasn't even his own speech. It was somebody else's speech. They made no showing that he had any intention to further any kind of terrorist activity whatsoever. And their argument was, we don't even need to make that showing. It's enough for us to show that there's a link on a website, because that's the provision of expert advice or assistance to terrorism. And if that theory had succeeded, there would be nothing to stop the government from prosecuting the Washington Post or the New York Times for putting on its website, in an article about Osama bin Laden, a link to one of Osama bin Laden's most recent video or taped threats. There would be no defense for the New York Times to say, well, we didn't do it to further terrorism. We did it to educate the people about what Osama bin Laden is saying, because this statute is written that broadly.
We're also joined by Marwan Mossad, personal friend of Sami Omar al-Hussein. Can you talk about where Sami is and what this has meant for him?
You mean where Sami is right now?
Yes.
Sami is still in jail here in Ada County in Boise, Idaho. Hopefully it shouldn't be too long before he goes home, though. I guess, you know, to Sami, this is... This is the end of a chapter that threatened his whole life as well as his family's. We didn't know what was going to end up happening. This could have turned into years and years of being in jail in the U.S. As opposed to him being home with his family and serving his country, doing something with the degree that he got here. Sammy's relieved. He's very happy and satisfied. I'm sure that he's able to put this behind him and continue once he's out of here.
Can you talk about Sami's family?
Sami's family went through a lot in the U.S. They finally had to leave the country because they were threatened of being deported. And I'm speaking of his wife and his three children. Actually, two of them were deportable. The third one wasn't, because he was American.
How old are the kids?
8, 6, and 3.
And how long has Sami been in jail?
Sami has been in jail since February 26th of 2003.
So he's been in jail now for more than a year. How have his kids responded? They're pretty young.
Initially, they didn't quite understand what was going on, but as things kind of sunk in, there was some resentment towards their dad for a little while because he's gone. Of course, they don't understand why he's gone or the fact that he's not doing it on purpose. And then as things went on, they were able to actually visit him in jail, and things kind of got a little better. But the oldest one seemed to have been the one who was most affected by what was going on, and his teachers in school even appeared to have noticed, and his mother had a little bit of trouble with him. Nothing too bad, but he was just a little more depressed than a kid his age normally is.
Have you seen Sammy since he was acquitted on the terrorism charges?
I have not visited him in jail since he was acquitted. I saw him in court at the time of the announcement of the verdict, and I just barely got to wave hello and congratulations to him. Hopefully I intend to visit him maybe this coming up weekend.
What has happened to the Muslim students at the University of Idaho in light of all of this, and particularly the Muslim Student Association?
Well, I guess you can say that the activities that the Muslim students were doing at the university faded away quite considerably. Before Sammy was arrested, there was a lot of work being done, such as, you know, playing Islamic movies in the U of I theater, you know, movies such as the message that inform people about Islam and what it's about. There was also like debates, lectures, and these kinds of things that were being that were provided. After Sammy was arrested, I guess there was a wave of scare. Everybody was worried about doing anything that has to do with Islam, because they felt like what Sammy was doing was essentially just volunteering towards some Islamic activity. And then they felt that doing that in any other context would also be dangerous.
Mm. David Cole, you have written a piece in today's Washington Post talking about more than 5,000 foreigners who have nothing to do with terrorism being locked up. And you write, for 2.5 years, little has been done to rectify the situation. But today, several senators and representatives plan to introduce the Civil Liberties Restoration Act of 2004, a bill that seeks to ensure the next time we suffer a terrorist attack, we'll hold fast to basic principles of fairness, due process, and human rights, especially in our treatment of foreign nationals. Can you explain this act that's being introduced today?
This is an incredibly important act, the Civil Liberties Restoration Act. It does not address this material support statute that Sami al-Hussein and the Virginia paintball people were convicted under, although that statute has been declared unconstitutional in a separate case that I'm involved in California. But this particular statute, the Civil Liberties Restoration Act, really tries to respond to some of the worst abuses that we have seen in the wake of 9/11, and that is the use of immigration authority to lock up people who have nothing whatsoever to do with terrorism, who we have no evidence that they're dangerous, and who are locked up largely because they are from Arab and Muslim countries. It would end the practice of secret hearings, blanket secret hearings, which was something we used for most of these post 9/11 detainees. It would require the government to make a showing that someone is dangerous or a risk of flight before he is locked up, which is a pretty basic requirement. It would end the notion that the government can require people from Arab and Muslim countries to come in and register and be fingerprinted and photographed. So it really seeks to kind of restore some of the basic liberties that that are owed to every human being in the United States, but were denied across the board to Arab and Muslim foreign nationals in the wake of 9/11.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, David Cole of Georgetown University, as well as the friend of Sami al-Hussein, Marwan Mossad, who is a fellow student at the University of Idaho again. Sami Omar al-Hussein has been acquitted of all terrorism charges in the case where he was the webmaster of several Islamic sites. This is Democracy Now! If you'd like to get a copy of the show, you can call 1-800-881-2359, or you can go to our website at democracynow.org. As we continue our Exception to the Ruler's book and media tour this week, we'll be in Chicago Thursday night at 8 at the Doubletree Hotel at Chicago O'Hare Airport. Then on Friday at Madison, Wisconsin, 6 o'clock at the 10th Anniversary Dinner for Center for Media and Democracy. We'll move on to Stevens Point, Wisconsin, on Saturday at the Renewable Energy and Sustainable Living Fair, sponsored by the Midwest Renewable Energy Association. That's in Stevens Point at 3 p.m. Saturday. Saturday evening back in Madison at the Barrymore Theater, 7:30, and in Milwaukee on Sunday at 1 o'clock, Wisconsin Room, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. You can get more information at our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabdo Kadus, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, and Rich Kim, our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.